Welcome to a new episode of the Life Science Get Together podcast, early in the morning with a cup of coffee and a cup of tea. And I'm very happy today to talk with one of my investment colleagues from the Nordics, Tjaro Wekroth. Tjaro, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Christian. It's great to be here.
Tjaro, give us a little bit of background. What is your profession? What are you doing in the Nordics?
Well, at the moment, I call myself in social media profiles as an entrepreneur and investor. Sometimes I call myself a co-entrepreneur, which means that I'm definitely more than just an investor. But on the other hand, I'm not full-time entrepreneur in any of the companies I'm involved with. But I tend to stick with my companies for a quite long period of time, come hell or high water. So I don't. Once I'm committed, I tend to stick with the companies for a multiple years. Having said that, it's also important to cut your losses early. So it's a fine balance. My background is I'm originally actually a pharmacist, a apotheker, like they say in Central Europe, but I have not done that for a day in my life. It's just a degree from the university I've taken that gives me a certain scientific background in life sciences.
At which industries are you most interested currently? What excites you?
Well, that's been the same since I quit my day job 10 years ago. I'm only focusing on the two industries that I can claim to know something about. They are life sciences and fintech. Having worked in pharmaceutical industry for 5 years and then 11 years in investment banking, so that comes naturally. So I even if I'm from Finland, I try to stay away from games, which is a big industry here, and never work with mobile phone or that kind of technologies or pulp and paper for that matter. So my sector background is very untypical for a Finnish guy. On the other hand, that gives me a lot of freedom to operate because there's not a lot of competition.
You mentioned that your background is untypical for a Finnish guy. How does the typical Finnish life science and early stage community look like these days in your country?
It is growing, but it is still very small because we don't have much of a pharmaceutical industry in this country traditionally. It's, we have developed a few drugs, but it is not nowhere as big as it is in Denmark or even Sweden of the Nordic region, not to say the UK or Central Europe. But there is a very well-growing medtech community. Medtech requires obviously less capital and shorter time spans. Mm-hmm. So and we've had some success stories also in the public market in medtech. So that is going well. More and more business angels coming in, and quite a few VCs are making grounds in Finland in medtech. The pharmaceuticals or drug development is still very, it's not really on a professional or scaling level. There's the old pharma project coming now and then. There are a few public companies in the junior stock market, but we don't have the same depth like they do in Sweden and Denmark.
Mm-hmm. How is you mentioned that some companies are listed on the I guess Finnish stock market? How does it work in Finland? Are these more mature companies that get listed, or are they also from the early stages of development?
The early stage, but we only have one real mature pharma company. And even that is quite small in the pharma scale. It's like 3 or 4 million market cap, I guess.
Okay.
But not all of them are listed in Helsinki. Some decide to list in Stockholm or in London. One of the more interesting ones is actually listed in London. So the capital market being always a reflection of the local industrial strength and heritage, That means that it is easier often for the emerging life science companies from Finland to raise capital from elsewhere. But having said that, like I said, in MedTech, it is getting easier and better also in Finland.
Why do you think it's easier for MedTech than for drug development companies? What's your view on the situation?
Well, here we have two reasons, really. One is general. It is not as complicated. People can understand what a device that measures your blood glucose or whatever that does. So general business angels can do a MedTech. They can understand, you're comfortable with that. And that is a general reason. Then specific for this country, I guess, is that we've had a couple of successful publicly listed MedTech companies that have opened the doors and shown others that it can be done and made quite a lot of people rich. So then that capital tends to be invested back into the same sector. The one company I mentioned is called Revenio, which is a world leader in glaucoma screening and has in the last 10 years grown from, I guess, like 20 million market cap to 2 billion. So that has been a very good example for others that it can be done.
From 20 million to 2 billion market capitalization.
Don't take me on the details. That is approximate scale. Yeah. It could be 1.5 or 2.5 now, or what I know.
And the company is listed in Helsinki, or is it? Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. That's a great success for the stock market.
Yeah, sure. Although that's still a very much a small cap on in the international standards, particularly on the pharma. So, when I worked in London in investment banking, small mid-cap pharmaceuticals were sharing AG, the German one that used to still exist at that time, 15 billion market cap, that was a small mid-cap space. And now we are talking about a success story that has reached 2 billion market cap 15 years later. So it's all relative.
Now, I'm pretty amazed with the pandemic. A lot changed also on the stock market. When I think back to the time when I started in the life science industry, it was 2006. These life science investments were more for private equity funds, experts in the field. And after the pandemic, when I look now on the market and talk with people, I think everybody knows names like BioNTech, Moderna. And 15 years ago, when I told my friends I'm moving into life science, they simply said, are you nuts? Are you crazy? What are you doing? This industry doesn't understand. It's really difficult to understand for everybody. You have a vast experience in different roles of investment. You have a background in investment banking. You act as a business angel. And what I remember from our past talks, you also had an eye or have an eye on crowdfunding. Let's talk a little bit about the differences between the different investment roles. How do you view the life of business angels today when they are interested to invest in MedTech and drug development? What are the secrets behind success for them?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Business angels and drug development. Unfortunately, I have to say I'm quite skeptical there. Mm-hmm. Because you really need deep pockets. And of course, while we could talk, what is the definition of a business angel? And what is the difference? Well, where's the borderline between a business angel and a family office? Mm-hmm. But to get the drug going really into phase one, that requires millions or tens of millions.
which not often even a group of software engineers is willing to put into one project. I have to say I'm rather skeptical on whether a business angel, unless he's really experienced and deep-pocketed, should get involved in drug development in the first place, period. That's haven't been there, made that mistake, guilty as everybody. I shouldn't make it again. And I knew that I was making a mistake. So people are not always behaving rationally, that's for sure. But I think it
that's
is
true.
A, you start to be an early investor in an emerging drug project. In medtech, it is a very different matter, of course, because unlike in drug development, the capital requirements are reasonable, and then you don't need to wait for 15 years for the company to really make it. I tried to mitigate the risks by focusing on like university spin-offs, where you have already like 5 or 10 year basic science behind the project before it is made into a company. Mm. And quite a lot of public investment as well. So then as a private investor, you can utilize the public money that has gone into the project, and which obviously is non-dilutive. But still, even so, with all these caveats, it is it's a difficult field to really make rational, successful investments.
Yeah, drug development is a very special animal. I think you mentioned it takes until to come to a significant value inflection point, probably 20 to 30 million per project. You know, just think about the preclinical studies, manufacturing, and when business angels can't mitigate the risk over several projects, it's really challenging to be part of that. Mm-hmm. Except those who have experience in the field. And when I look at the development of business angels that became successful in life science and later on went to raise funds, most of them were scientists, started with a company, made money on two ends. On one hand, they founded the company and got shares of the company. On the other hand, they got also a salary. So it's basically mm-hmm. after Series A, B, and C, they could move forward. MedTech also agreed... the sums, I think, are much smaller to come to a significant value inflection point to also have a chance to sell the company or get it listed on the stock market.
Sorry, having said all that, 2 weeks ago, I was in Berlin and I had a lunch with a VC fund manager that I know based in Berlin. And we discussed the recent developments, of course. And it was fantastic to be traveling again. I had a Since COVID started, that was only the third time I was abroad.
I agree to that.
That was interesting. But regarding COVID, he told me about this BioNTech, the German company, which of course everybody knows by now because of the vaccine. But I didn't know before he told me the background that there's this German pharma company, I think it's Hexal family company, who has invested in that early and made very nice investment out of it. So that obviously can work. And we have a very recent success story where a private early investor has done well of a drug development company and very high risk one for that matter. But that is obviously out of, I would be out of my league there and most people who call themselves business angels. Because in that case, the family had tens of years of experience in the pharma industry. And there are hundreds of millions to invest. So yes, if you are
empty pockets,
if you are in that fortunate position and you know what you're doing, yeah, go for it. But any regular business angel, I wouldn't recommend.
I mean, the thing is, I'm no expert in BioNTech. I know the company. The company did a great job in developing a vaccine. What impressed me was the quick time to patients. Within 12 months, they went through basically the early IND enabling studies up to phase 3 and got an emergency use application from the regulators in Europe and the United States. But the thing is, when they started, I think it was in 2008, the risk of a novel platform technology to fail is almost 100%. So many companies that start with a promising technology really fail, not because of management failures or lack of money. It's just simply when the science doesn't work in patients, you can't move forward. Yeah. And so everybody investing in early stages must understand that it can be a jackpot. But I would say 99 out of 100 cases won't make it even close to getting listed. Do you see that similar or differently?
I very much agree with you. And then I would just make the obvious conclusion that expected return is most likely negative. So if you multiply the, or quantify the success multiplied by the probability of that success, and then loss you make in case of failure multiplied by the probability of that failure, I guess you end up with a negative number. But then somebody told me that in his view, the world history and mankind proceed and go forward by driven by people who do stupid things. So I guess this might be another example where seemingly irrational behavior turns out to be good for the mankind as a whole. So nothing but as inspirational and admiration for these kind of people who do that.
Yeah, I think the companies must click into the value chain when you look at, there is this ARC fund in the United States. It's run by Cathie Wood. I became a huge fan, so I'm a member of her fan club, actually. And she put together a fund, an ETF that's called the Genomics Revolution, where she invests money specifically in companies of which she thinks in gene editing can make a difference in future. It's a mixed portfolio of diagnostics and drug development companies and also very early basic research companies. What's interesting is that the landscape changed when I entered in 2006 in the industry. In Europe, it was mostly working with SPVs, for companies that are focusing on a single asset, on one drug only, moving them forward and trying to sell it to the pharma industry. And when I look now at her portfolio companies, they mostly have a large pipeline in the background. So they mitigate basically the risk internally with running 10 to 20 projects at the same time, and sometimes have a decent valuation on the stock market going into the tenths of billions. Do you see, from your investment banking background, do you see a chance that the life science industry, now fueled with SARS-CoV-2, gets another push, that more and more companies go public and also open up investments for private investors that can stay away from business angels but come into a later stage of development and still make decent returns?
Well, that is quite a lot a question of both fundamentals and sentiment. Mm. But I guess my answer would be yes. When we have again a new wave of successful companies like BioNTech and Moderna that show that you really can do it, I think that will inevitably support the interest of private investors, public in the pharma and medtech sectors in the public markets, but also there will be more money coming in from the LPs into the VC funds. Which in return, of course, will feed the development of companies in these fields. So that is, I do think that is likely. But then again, which will be the sector or the field within pharmaceuticals where the next success stories will come? I don't know. I don't believe that will be vaccines. We need to remember that this mRNA technology was not really mainly being developed for vaccines or infections before COVID-2, that was for oncology, which really, mm-hmm. of course, remains a big field. So that was a very opportunistic but great and a fantastic move to start using the technology for, as an ad hoc, very fast basis for a vaccination. But then, will the focus again return to oncology? Will there be something else that will get most of the capital? Don't know. My personal bet is, and I'm partly talking my own book here because I have a investment in a company in this field, would be neurology. Mm-hmm. And
Well, when I was ending my career in investment banking as a analyst covering the pharma companies, then a lot of big pharma were withdrawing from CNS field. Mm-hmm. Companies like Pfizer's and Glaxo's were withdrawing from Depression, which had been a very, very big market in after the launch of Prozac, basically. And then since then, we've had multiple failures, drug after drug in Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases. So there's every month there was another one bites the dust kind of news that, okay, now there was failure in phase two, quite often even in phase three after promising phase two results. So that has been a very, very sad story. Now, after Biogen got the first drug through the FDA for Alzheimer's, well, there may be a lot of follow-on drugs in that field, because it can be done. And the pricing, of course, is controversial. And no matter what you think about the FDA decision, that is a genuine game changer, I would call it, in Alzheimer's, obviously, but then possibly in the CNS field more generally. So, and of course, with the double aging of population, we all should hope for that, for new developments and new breakthroughs in the CNS field.
Yeah, there was a huge controversial discussion about the Biogen approval. But what's your opinion about the FDA move that, as far as I remember, they pulled out an old drug, presented new data, and got it approved, even though the efficacy is not that promising? But what's your opinion on the Biogen approval? Why did the FDA do that?
I don't want to express an opinion on the decision and chart whether that is like right or wrong from the FDA. Perhaps it is enough to say that I was surprised by the pricing afterwards. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the FDA does not have any role in the pricing decision, but Biogen obviously took the view that they don't really care about the public opinion.
it's a five digit number per treatment. I think do you know the exact pricing? I think it was.
I have seen it, but it was like closer to 100,000 per year.
Ah, yeah,
on that level, and I was expecting something like 5-10. So, and I'm not familiar with the technology, how it is manufactured. Mm. So perhaps it is difficult to manufacture, so they could not choose the strategy of making it a mass drug with 5,000 per year pricing, and so it has been more profitable on a limited number of patients and high price tag. I don't know. It could be either or. But coming back to my own personal interest here, I have been I was actually the first outside investor, and have been a investor in all the consequent rounds in a Finnish company called Combinostics, mm-hmm. which is, well, had the Swedish CEO and now actually just hired a German CEO, but still based in Finland. And it is doing early stage screening of Alzheimer's. So this is the reason why I'm obviously full disclosure, I'm kind of talking my own book here, because for a company that has been using the AI and machine learning tools for early detection of the disease, the best thing that can happen is that there is the first disease modifying drug coming to the market, because then suddenly the biggest challenge disappears, which has been that there's no real incentive to do an early detection or diagnosis of the disease, because there's no real effective intervention. Now there is, and I'm sure there will be more when other pharma companies return to the CNS field.
Your explanation clicks very well into another explanation I heard in the so-called All In podcast. It's a podcast that's run out of San Francisco by four American investors. And one of them is Chamath Palantir, I hope I speak his name right. And his theory was that the FDA wanted to create a market for similar to reasons that you mentioned. He also said there was nothing going on for years in Alzheimer or other CNA diseases because it's complicated. A lot of money was burned. Big pharma failed. Investors failed. And basically, the sentiment on the market was, let's get out of it. It's untreatable, it's uncurable. And he mentioned that with the move of the FDA and also accepting the high pricing, what they're basically doing is creating a market with a low entry barrier. They said, look, guys, there is not much going on in the field. We accept drugs. We have now one approved. It's not the best one. Just challenge it and make a better one. And you can then become the second or third drug with better efficacy data or better safety data for patients. And also what you mentioned for the diagnostics. I mean, now there is a field for diagnostics and that motivates scientists to move further into that field. I very much like this explanation of how money can really help to cure people.
Yeah, I agree there. But then one issue that will come back to the surface now is this, in health policy terms, is that, the pricing, who should have the control of the pricing? And in the last 20, 30 years, the regulator who approves the drugs has not had any influence on the pricing. Like in Europe, EMA approves the drugs, and then it is up to the market or the most member states in the EU. It is the government who then decides whether it is reimbursed or not. And I think that is still a sound policy, and I personally support it. But I do think it will come under attack now after Biogen's approval. I'm sure if FDA had any say on pricing, they probably wouldn't have recommended such a price for Biogen. And of course, now they can partly be blamed for it because they, quite rationally, they put a phase four requirement on the drug that you really need to show that it works. And then the company come back to say that, yeah, that's very expensive. That's why we need to price it high and so on. So it is a complex issue. And I don't think there's one right or wrong answer. But I do think this discussion will come back to the surface again.
I think this is a very important discussion that we need to have on a social level. What's the right pricing for drugs? I mean, on one hand, it's the availability also for everybody in the world. So that first-class medicine is not only available to the rich, but also to the poor. When I just look at SARS-CoV-2, I mean, basically everybody in the Western world has access to vaccines. And the WHO is complaining that poor countries, that healthcare workers and risk groups simply don't get vaccines. On the other hand, knowing what drug development does cost, actually, I mean, a new therapy is at the minimum $1 billion. Up to three. When I look at Alzheimer, I would assume, without knowing the number, it's just gut feeling, I would assume we go up to 5, 6, 7 billion invested to bring one drug on the market. And somehow the value chain must be fueled back with revenues from the market so that we can also develop the next generation of drugs. How do you see this pricing discussion, especially the problematic between rich countries and poor countries? Do you have any solution in mind?
No, not really. I wish I had, but if it was an easy one, I'm sure it would have been solved. The only addition I would make, perhaps, is that it's one thing to look at the population at one spot. Point of time. Mm-hmm. Then, also, of course, you can also make the argument that you can look at human beings who live during the flow of time. So now, when we start from somewhere and there is a drug that is being used, yes, mainly for the rich now, but then when the patent expires 20 years from now, it is very cheap to use globally. So the even limited availability right now helps, even among the rich people, will help people or poor people 20 years from now, because then we get somewhere. And then do we have a response? This gets very philosophical. Do we have a responsibility for all the people who live now, or also for people who are will be alive 20 years from now? I don't have an answer, but this will get very blurry, of course, from ethical point of view.
Yeah, I think for generations, it was survival of the human race. When I look now on the planet, I think the survival of the human race is not a problem anymore. So it's now making our life better. Discussion of fairness, and I think these are these complicated matters that need a lot of debate and discussion, and I don't also think that there is an easy solution to that.
I agree. There will need to be a lot of discussion and debate, but I think we are fooling ourselves if we think that in the end of the discussion there will be a clear answer that everybody will agree on. That does not happen.
Yeah. I mean, also when I look at the capitalist system, I think it's open to everybody to make money. When I look on the stock market, everybody can invest, and yet so few people are really doing it. Let's go back to the availability of capital. I think this is one problem that I do see currently in Europe. I mean, it got a little bit better with the SARS-CoV-2 vaccines. How do you see the availability of capital for early stage companies in medtech and drug development in Europe? Do we have enough money in that field, or could it be improved?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligence strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
Well, in this country we don't, but that's a special case. I think it's very easy to say that there's lack of capital when actually quite often there's a lack of good projects. Because there's lack of capital, that kind of that's an argument that doesn't not really have a opponent. There just is no capital. If you say that the project was bad and that's why it was not supported, then you kind of blame the project, and no one wants to do that unnecessarily. The people who walk away and do not invest, they don't want to say it, because then they will need to end up spending time with arguing with the project they are walking away from and not looking at the next one. So this becomes easily a truism, whether it is true or not. But on a general level, I do think pharma industry, like drug development, is more tricky to support with commercial money than average, because of the reasons that we've gone through already. And I think, and this might be an odd comment to come from a capitalist, but I do think a public money and state support is warranted in early stage drug development. Because otherwise, I guess a lot of good projects do not get off the ground. I have been doing in the past this Horizon 2020, expert work for the European Commission, and I just saw that the new project is kicking off this summer. So, and I had a brief look at the criteria. And I think that is a very good project on a European level. Every small country like Austria or Finland is too small to have a reasonable or sensible public support program for a drug research. I think that kind of projects are very justified in drug development. And some money should be, I'm very happy as a taxpayer to see some of the money being directed towards early stage, very risk. Like moonshot projects. I think that is a good idea. But still, don't believe when somebody says there's lack of capital. Quite often it is not the case that the lack of good projects and sensible teams, because I guess every business angel has seen a very good project, solid science, but then a team where the founder is not really a person you want to support or commit to support for many years to come.
Let's stay a little bit on this point, the importance of a team. Can you explain it a little bit more, what it means that you also need the right team to develop the technology? What are you looking at when you interview a team for investment?
Well, I'm afraid I don't have anything new to say there. Anything I say will sound like a cliche. You need both the Jobs and the Wozniak. I guess that's all I can say. So often you have a good technology, particularly in this country, Finland. We have great engineers, good science, but then we don't have the Steve Jobs guy. We don't have the commercial angle, marketing, sales. They are underdeveloped, and you need that as well. But everybody knows that. It's nothing new.
That's a good question. I mean, if everybody knew it, why is not everybody looking at that? It's the same with listed companies. So some, especially when I talk with continental European companies, it doesn't matter if it's early stage or later stages, they very often just promote the technology. With a great technology, it works. When I look at companies listed in the United States, many CEOs are the Steve Jobs guys, Steve Jobs personalities, who have a big vision, a grand vision, and who also have the drive to move the company forward. Mm-hmm. I really wonder when I work with incubation programs and acceleration programs that there is not more emphasis on that part. I think it's really the key part of success to a company. One investor in one podcast interview said, an A team with a B technology will always be better than a B team with an A technology. So it's really looking at this team angle. And it's good to hear from you that you see it similar. I think this is one of the most important things that we should emphasize when founding companies.
Mm-hmm. You're right. But then you need both, really. I mean, because just the, like we talk on a general terms, like European, American way of doing things, none of them is really correct in their own right. Let me ask you, do you think Theranos would have happened in Europe? Because in a way, you can argue that while many countries, many people in Europe develop the technology to mass and forget the commercial angle, then you can make the similar argument that in the US, quite often, you can just live with a story without having substance. And Theranos obviously being a ultimate example of that. So you do need a solid scientific basis and good engineering combined with the commercial angle and selling the story, really, to not only your customers, but to the financiers as well. But then again, I'm thinking aloud here, well, very close to you, there was, we had in fintech side, we had a very bad case of unrealized expectations, Wirecard. Which I also had a few chats about in Germany when I was in Berlin, and in a way you can argue that it was a European Theranos, but on a different field, obviously.
Yeah, Wirecard is a story on its own. It's one of the black swan events of the last year that are just unbelievable. It looked like a good company, good team, good space, good area. And when I also look now on the companies operating in the field, PayPal, Square, also the old traditional credit card companies like Visa, MasterCard, they're all doing well. They just need to move forward and be part of the game, and Wirecard. Mm-hmm. With a very interesting story, let's say it just was a huge case of fraud. And no matter how good the due diligence is, I think this cannot be avoided entirely, such a risk. And unfortunately, with Wirecard, a lot of retail investors lost a lot of money because they were just throwing all the capital on one company in that field. And this is the real tragedy behind it, because all these regulations, I think they're coming from the 18th, 19th century, with the picture of the rich white capitalist man who has enough money, who can invest in a company. But when I look at the reality of retail investment these days, they simply invest their possessions, bet it all on one company, and then have to face the same regulations like multi-billion dollar funds. So I think this will be a regulatory question, and also a philosophical question, how to treat this situation so that such cases like Wirecard won't happen anymore.
That is that takes us to the, not sure if you wanted to go there yet, but that goes us to the other field of mine, which is, let's say, public investments and crowdfunding mm-hmm. and all that. And I'm very familiar with the regulation on that, both on the European level and the Nordics. It is quite weird how different the regulation and customer protection is. If you look at the, what is called crowdfunding, i.e. investments from retail investors, a big number of them into risky projects. Mm-hmm. There has been a lot of focus on the investor protection. And like many companies, many member states in Europe have required that you cannot invest more than 1,000 euros in a project or not more than 10% of your net worth, like that was the UK approach. And a lot of warnings and so on. That is justified. I think that is very well justified in investor protection point of view. But then on the other hand, in the public market, you don't have that. In wealth management, yes, but like you say, a guy from Vienna or Munich could put all his pension money into Wirecard. And there's no such safeguards if you just do it via online broker. I don't know whether it should or not, but I do think it is weird that we're treating legally different, but in practice very similar projects and investment cases very so differently from regulatory point of view. I think, and this is a controversial thought that I have been saying for years, that crowdfunding actually is really nothing new. People have been doing that since the Phoenicians in the antique times, yep. when they invest in a ship or cargo jointly. So that's nothing new. It's just now done by the internet. But the controversial thought is that actually IPOs and public investment, they are crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. They are crowdfunding. You just collect money from retail investors, throw in a few VCs or institutional investors into the mix, and then you have a wide shareholder base. Then whether you do it on a paper or papyrus for that matter or over the internet, that is just the question of the technology of the day that you use.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, crowdfunding is an old instrument. It's just, I think, reinvented and reutilized with the internet technology. How to protect it? I mean, I always thought, on one hand, I think there is a lack of investment expertise available in our society. I think this is education is one problem. It cannot all be just with, let's call it with regulatory changes. But on the other hand, when a company is listed in a premium European index like the DAX, and also audited by one of the world's best auditing firm. And then I see that there is almost no penalty at the end when $2 billion are just missing. And everything is blamed on the retail investors. I think that systemically there is something not really just and right, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're right that retail investor who puts money in a DAX 30 company should be able to trust the auditors. So I think AY definitely has a lot to answer in that case, which obviously is not the case in early stage crowdfunding. But then also it just happened. So you can argue that all these regulations and that we have in place don't seem to work, not in the public market because of Wirecard. And then these protections that we have in so-called crowdfunding space, mm-hmm. like unlisted, there have been huge frauds there as well. From very different angles or regulatory approaches, we always seem to be getting the failures through. So perhaps we would need to have a full re-engineering from bottom up
of all financial regulations. And it should be, I think, very agnostic towards the status outside of the company, and should be more transparent so that people would learn them and be able to follow them. Because now we have this patchwork of regulation, and not even a lawyer or specialist in the field can remember by heart all the regulations, which then enables bad guys like this. Who was the name of the Austrian guy who was the head of Marcus Braun?
Marcus Braun, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Then that patchwork lets that kind of cruise through.
Nothing good comes out when Austrians go to Munich to conquer the world, in any case.
That's what the Germans told me in Berlin 2 weeks ago. That was in context of Wirecraft, yes.
Yeah. I mean, enforced diversification, when the way out of to manage risk is to diversify in a portfolio. And what you said in crowdfunding, that seems to work well. It's the own responsibility of any investor. So, I mean, when I look at Warren Buffett, for example, a pro in the field with, I think, 44% or 46% of his Berkshire Hathaway fund or conglomerate is invested in Apple. It's one company. So very risky. But for the average retail investors, they always think when you think you understand and know the company, always assume you don't. It's just as long as you can't invest €500,000 in a proper due diligence team, send it to a company and review it properly, always assume you don't know anything about the company.
Sure. And I've learned that now. Also, we discussed earlier that I've moved more into the public space. And it's always so that no matter whether the company is public or private startup, you really learn to know the company and the team after you have invested. So yes, you can do all the DD you like, but then you really learn to know the strengths and the weaknesses and the risks and the opportunities only after you have put in the money. Then the learning really starts.
It's a good angle that you're taking. So you moved from the business angel crowdfunding space now more to the publicly traded space. What are the three main differences between these three investment styles that you see?
The obvious one as a board member, if you are one, are the responsibilities. In publicly traded company, of course, you need to have the confidentiality, inside information. They need to be really professionally handled. And even if Wirecard might make you think otherwise, there are really sanctions if you don't follow the rules. While a lot of the regulation and laws, like MAR, the market abuse regulation, they don't really apply for the unlisted space because the shares are not public traded instruments. But even so, it is in a similar, it's very similar in a sense that it's better to just behave like any company was a public company, even if it's not, because more regulation in a way that just good habits, like good manners to treat your other people and co-investors with respect. So that's one big difference. And then I think psychologically, very important is that at least I'm not aware of a way how to short a unlisted stock. Because in a private company, all the information you give out, that is always intended for the next VC, for B round, C round, and so on, so that somebody comes in and puts more money into the company. In a public space, any information that goes out can be used by for similar purposes, but then again, there always can be a hedge fund who wants to short your stock. And that's a good thing because that keeps a certain level of discipline in the market. Even Wirecard was attacked by the short sellers, and they were right, of course, in the end. That kind of mechanism is missing from the private market. And I don't see how it could be done, but I think it would be a good to have that whip available for somebody to keep the management and the board in line.
Yeah, this is an interesting perspective, short selling on private companies. I mean, when I look on the market, I think Wirecard was an exceptional case, but luckily it's not the norm. It's just an exception. And what you say is transparency. I think it's a very important point. That also makes sense for private companies, always be as transparent as possible with your investors and honest and upfront. If there are problems, tell them. Everybody can deal with problems and don't hide them away. So I think the companies start going southwards when there is a lack of transparency. And this is tapping more into the personality of the board members. When I look at listed companies, I expect that they have a certain level of transparency already established. And also when hiring their executives, that they look for proven track records and trained people in the field to know how to handle that. The short selling, I have no idea how that can work with private companies. The public market. I mean, there was this, what I find interesting currently on the public market is the reverse short selling that comes out of Reddit, where retail investors gather up and do pretty much the same like short sellers, but just the other way around. They look for stock that have a high percentage of their shares sold short, like GameStop, for example, and then start betting on that they can push the short sellers out when they throw enough money on the company. How do you see that development?
It's a free world. That's a dangerous game, but I think that's just a very healthy mechanism to be there, for sure. But that's called short squeeze, of course. But I'm afraid retail investors will eventually lose a lot of money doing that as well, because a short case that is unjustified by the fundamentals can turn against you. So a Reddit driven short squeeze that is not based on fundamentals, of course, can blow in your face. I have not been following so closely, but I would assume that some of cases like that would have already happened.
I was following it. I got aware of that in January. And I think GameStop is interesting because the major shareholder is also an American billionaire who also made his money with Apple. He invested 90% of his capital into one company, similar like Warren Buffett, and then the other one in GameStop. The interesting thing was I saw it similar in January. Like you did, that it's very risky for retail investors, and looked a little bit at the community, and the feedback I got from this Reddit community was quite interesting. I think it's an interpretation. I see mostly millennials in that field, so young people. And interestingly, when I pointed out in chat discussions with them that it's risky, that they can lose money, most of them who responded are fully aware of the risk. And there was just this baseline response where they said, it's gambling. We know that. We gamble. So I think as long as people are aware of what they are doing and they know it's this investment style is gambling, it's funny. But what I think is good on a social level is that with this new trend, let's call it social media trading, or like Robin Hood, who also makes investment accessible to people with small pockets. I think there is a huge percentage of young people getting engaged at a very early age with the stock market and start training the right habits. In the end of the day, I think creating wealth and positive returns on the stock market is just a matter of training. And to present it in a fun and entertaining way is, in my eyes, a good thing.
Yeah, I very much agree. I'm not sure how that would be said in English. Are the people's capitalist, is that a thing? Volkskapitalism in German. We have a very similar word in Finnish. I'm that to the core. I really believe in it strongly that the benefits of the success of new innovations and companies should be widely distributed to the society and to the population. And Of course, one could argue that it is good to do that via taxation, and then there's also benefits and there's also transfers. And they, of course, have their place in the whole. But when there's a widely spread share ownership of companies, that involves also the market mechanism and a genuine feeling of where the where money comes from, basically, and innovations and what drives the world forward. And I don't know about you, but I don't really get that feeling when I pay tax or look at the corporate, well, the public governance. So then I think that's good, and it drives the society in the whole into the right direction. So fully agreed. And I'm actually one of the companies I'm involved with is it's mainly in Finland now, but it's started as a equity research boutique, but it's now more like a community management for small shareholders, between small shareholders and public companies. And I see a lot of further developments on that direction. There will be a lot of new companies, business models coming up. And I think even some European companies are growing quite nicely. On top of this US-driven social investment credit type of investment, which hopefully will become more informed and educated going forward.
I mean, it's a philosophical question that you raised. So it's the is taxation better than investments? Is distribution of wealth by politicians the solution to everything? I was a happy taxpayer before 2020. So I also believe to have certain social standards established on a European scale is a good thing for society. No poverty, accessible healthcare system. After 2020, I'm not so sure anymore. I think the best way to handle complexity in our society is to have a lot of small companies and a lot of people trying out different things, and nature will take care that the fittest will survive. And those ideas that don't work, they don't move forward anyways. So I think there is a lot of solution potential in this crowd-based funding that goes over the stock market to just bet on the right thing. So I don't think that politicians do they have the right systems in place to solve complex problems that we face these days, like climate change, for example.
That's an interesting thought. So what specifically drove that change of mind, change of heart of yours? Why did you change your mind? Obviously, it must have been something to do with COVID.
When I look at the decisions that were made in the past 18 months in handling the disease and analyzing the disease, I think a lot of regulations have been put in place that simply don't have a benefit. Or a limited benefit. So when I compare, for example, wearing masks is mandatory in many states. Austria went down the route that FFP2 masks are mandatory of wearing. But when I look at the evidence and when I read through studies, I don't see much justification for that. So, but now we are sticking with this regulation for 6 months. It's a similar thing when I look at distribution of vaccines, for example. The WHO says, please don't vaccinate people below 18 because we have a lack of vaccines worldwide. And there is a lot of pressure in Austria to vaccinate children. So I see a little bit of disconnect between what works and what the evidence shows and political decisions. So I think politics are good. I mean, it's also in other European countries, politics went down the route of micromanaging everything. So I also see it in Germany, see it in France, I see it in the United Kingdom. And I mean, did we get rid of the coronavirus in the last 12 months? I don't think so. But we put regulations in place that tried to achieve that goal, even though it was clear it doesn't go down this route. So the claim that comes up now with all this COVID is, okay, how can we pay back the debt that we have taken out, tax the rich? It's just a redistribution of capital from companies and private people to political decision makers. So I asked myself the question, is that really helping to simplify the complex problems we have right now, to just take money from the private side and redistribute it to politicians and give them the power of choice how we solve problems? Or is it better to let the money work and be deployed into companies and redeployed into companies with investments, either via revenues or via direct investments, and make those entrepreneurs work on solving the problems? And when I look on what really happens right now in the world, where the big solutions came from in the past 20 years, for example, BioNTech, it was financed by a family office. And it was moved forward by a couple, basically. They put together the basic science, they had the drive, they had the expertise, and they were also supported by Bill Gates. These are all not politicians. So, and they brought forth a solution. When I...
It's an interesting thought. It's, but I think it's too early to tell which direction the overall sentiment will fall, because... you're making good arguments there. Then on the other hand, we haven't seen the states really impose their authority on people for, well, about 50, 60 years in this manner, like border, closing the borders and making this kind of compulsory new state imposed social norms. So you could also argue that now actually states are back. It will be more... More authoritative era we are entering. And I think it's too early to tell. I mean, it could turn turn either way. But what I would personally hope is that we would have more coordination, at least on European level, because this patchwork of travel restrictions, which seem to change not only within between countries, but also within countries. So not even the authorities seem to know what is now allowed and what is not. We should have more coordination, at least within Europe, so that we know what is forbidden and what is not. That's for sure. But then going to the next stage on what that will mean on macroeconomy, investments, and also, say, fintech and life sciences, my sectors. I think the big question is, will people trust the money and the structures we have in place? And that leads to the question whether we will have hyperinflation or not. And then there are consequent questions, whether the cryptos and gold will be a good thing to own or a bad thing to own. And then pricing power, if we have a very high inflation, then probably one of the good sectors to be in would be life sciences, drugs, because then there would be pricing power to really follow the depreciation of value of money, i.e. inflation. I think these are very interesting trends to follow in the next 1 to 3 years. And I don't have an answer, but I think any investor in general, in any sector, but also in life sciences and fintech should start to think about the risk, the black swan risk of hyperinflation again, because our generation has not really experienced that. Last time we had meaningful inflation was, well, in the early 90s, late 80s. And since then, we have forgotten what it really is like.
Yeah, I think it was in the 90s, the last time in Eastern Europe after the change in the political system in Eastern Europe. I think Romania was one of the countries that had vast hyperinflation for a period of time, which was really challenging for multinational companies to deal with that. But since then, it's pretty much stable. Mm. I mean, you also see the shift in Europe to a more authoritarian leadership style in politics. I'm just not confident that this is the right move to approach future problems, because most of the problems that we are talking right now, I mean, cryptocurrencies, for example, as you brought it up, these are complex problems. How can we prove our systems? How can we make them more trustworthy? What is the right system to move the money forward? Is it cryptocurrencies? Is it the old systems consisting of banks and a lot of decision makers in between? Also, when you look at the health problems, life science, it's a scientific community. And nobody knows everything. So the traditional way to solve scientific problems was by debate. And when you look at an authoritarian leadership style, an open debate is not really part of an authoritarian leadership style, in my opinion. Also, when you look at climate change or this electric cars or hydropowered cars, it's all complex issues that we are dealing with. And my personal opinion is that the libertarian lifestyle and decision-making style most likely resembles better nature and helps that the right decisions become the strongest via debate and put the right choices forward. But I think it's really philosophical at this point.
Mm. But I think COVID has certainly also led to some breakthroughs, like, of course, mRNA technology, but also like the tool we are using right now. Who had heard about Zoom and Teams calls 1.5 years ago? And of course, the technology was there, but it was not widely adopted. So in a way, we did not miss this good crisis. It led to something very very progressive and good use of technology going forward. And but then in the next phase, when we move into post-COVID world and see what happens take place and so on, I'm sure they also will continue to be innovation, but that's also the key question: where will innovation come from? Can we continue to utilize what we have learned now and take it to the next level, or do we turn conservative and just want to everything to be like it was in 2018, including, for instance, use of cash in German-speaking Europe, which really, really, really is weird to me. I mean, why do I need coins? I never use coins, except when Bitcoin. I go to Central Europe. I mean, but Finland is quite advanced, but Sweden is even more. So I don't think any Swede has coins. No, everything is wireless. Paid with credit card or like an Apple Watch, and the central bank over there is worried that when cash disappears and people don't have it anymore, then the in crisis situation that would be a risk for society. That doesn't seem to be the case in Central Europe yet, because everybody has cash.
It's
something that should go away.
This is this debate about personal freedom. So cash means personal freedom. It's connected to a high-ranked value in society.
But then you should actually use gold, because cash, even that, is issued by the government. You should really have small gold pieces and pay with that.
I mean, this is a long debate. The problem, one reason of poverty is difficulty of distributing gold and cash to a vast majority of people. So gold in the past, it was very risky to take gold with you, risk of robberies, theft, stuff like that. It's the same with cash. So every physical system is hard to distribute. What I really see moving forward, and interestingly, from the Cardano space, the founder of Cardano thinks, I think, also in that direction, that with digital wallets and cryptocurrencies, if every person is connected to the system, the distribution of cash basically becomes a simple solvable problem. But I agree, I mean, Austria sticks to cash, and politicians also claim that it's necessary to keep that alive. I don't see much reason why we should have physical money anyways. in the digital world.
But, so you think the main reason is attitude and like
It's a value. It's a social value.
So social value of what social value?
It's ingrained in the society, especially in the older population, that cash means freedom. That the ability of withdrawing money from a bank means freedom.
And then, freedom how? Of state interference or...
I can reflect on what I read. I'm not a huge fan of physical money anyway, so I don't see a reason why it's necessary to keep that.
You know, there is a very interesting startup that I almost invested in, based in Germany. Their value proposition is that you can have all your net worth in physical gold in Swiss mountains and still use that all the time. So when
and how?
If you, Christian, would have, let's say, €1 million worth of gold, and that would be all your net worth, and then that would be behind their service in Switzerland, inside the mountains, wherever, you would have a credit card. You would still have access to all that gold all the time, because when you pay, they would take a fraction of your gold stock and sell that on spot market in return of euros. Mm-hmm. And then if you buy a cappuccino in Starbucks, you would at the same time authorize them to make a transaction where you sell a portion of your gold. So you would own a little less gold and then instantly pay their fee. And then at the same time, pay the Starbucks for your cappuccino. And that is a very interesting concept. And do you think that would be acceptable to the elder Austrian population?
I think it's Michael Saylor from MicroStrategy puts the same narrative or similar narrative that you explained right now on the market, but it just uses Bitcoin instead of gold. So it's also his claim that he said, look, I mean, if you put all your money into Bitcoin, it's basically, in his opinion, digital gold. And the similarity between your idea and from the startup and Michael Saylor is that I think we have really the first time in human history where a person can move around the world freely and take the entire net worth with him or her. So it's basically wrapping everything up in Europe and moving to the United States is just a click. It's just a mouse click. And you put all your wealth into Bitcoin or into this gold concept. And then you travel to the United States and start a new life there. When I think back 50 years ago, it would have meant to withdraw all the money physically. I mean, in Europe, also credit cards were not really established back then. Then it depends on the net worth. I mean, selling all your real estate, and then you have huge suitcases of physical money to carry to another bank or deposit it in a bank in Europe and ask them to transfer it probably physically then to the United States. It was complicated. And now with the technology, I mean, this gold concept is one thing. And also the Bitcoin concept is going in the direction that money is really easy transferable.
Yeah, in a way. But then do you, I think it's too early to tell whether people will retain trust in Bitcoin over the cycles and their political interference. And then, of course, the electricity use and all that, they are issues. They may be solvable, but still they are still issues. But for now, I think Bitcoin is more a storage of wealth instead of payment system, because not many places accept it at the moment. And then the transaction costs still are quite uncomfortably high. Also in case of, let's say, a very difficult war, including nukes and like electromagnetic pulses and so on, would Bitcoin wallets survive? I don't have an answer, but that's something that will need to be solved. I still believe more people believe in gold in Swiss mountains physically than Bitcoin in the cloud. That may change.
But is it really safer? I mean, it's a matter of...
But my claim is that still more people trust that instead of Bitcoin, but that may be changed.
Just imagine, I mean, it means putting all your money into one startup company in the end of the day. So it's okay, it's gold in the Swiss mountains, but on the forefront is just one company.
Yeah, well,
what if this company is a second Wirecard?
sure, yeah. But I'm not talking about this particular company, but as a concept.
I think that the learning here is from Wirecard, don't put all eggs in one basket. It's a matter of diversification. But I think, I mean, the concepts that are coming now on the market are really great because it really makes people independent from how they manage their wealth in more non-traditional ways today than it was in the past. What was the past way? Real estate. You can buy houses. Mm. And if a war starts, everything goes back to zero. Now there are other means. Bitcoin is one, this gold idea is one, that you can also use gold for payment. Then there are other cryptocurrencies. Also, the stock market is much more flexible today than it was 30 years ago. I mean, just imagine buying stock in the 90s. It was a little bit more complicated than today. Today, it's a mouse click. So it's just going online, buying shares and selling them. I don't think it was that easy in the 90s. But what was your experience as an investment banker with these technological advancements? How was life for investment bankers in the 90s?
Well, I was actually investment banker from 2000 to 2011. Mm. I spent my late 1990s in a pharmaceutical industry.
Mm.
But then I think there's not that much change in investment banking because already since mid-90s, capital, for what it mattered in my world then, for institutional investors and big large-cap pharma companies, it was available and flew across borders very freely already.
Mm-hmm.
So a hedge fund in New York could short a stock in Frankfurt, or somebody in Spain could buy a stock in London. And that was very open already. So I think the bigger change is since 2010s is in the retail side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not only institutional investors can invest across borders. Now it is available for these REITs, Reddit guys and man on the street. And also like cash transfers. We have the N22s and Revoluts, and you can have multiple currency accounts in your mobile phone, which was of course unthinkable in the early, in 1990s. So I think the bigger changes have been on the retail side and the democratization of capital, which is, I think, very much a good thing, like we discussed earlier already. But then, of course, it will become more and more difficult for professional money managers and capital managers to really justify their existence because retail investors can invest directly in stocks instead of putting their money in mutual funds.
I think it's a great advancement for the average people on the streets, for retail investors. 80s, 90s, it was basically savings accounts and that was it, with an interest rate. People needed to create a certain amount of wealth to be eligible for more sophisticated instruments. And now it's open to everybody. Also, when I look at multinational companies, I think, as far as I remember from M&A, transferring money, I mean, when you don't have to do it, it looks easy. But looking into the 90s processes, it still was very complicated to transfer billions of dollars or euros around the world. For decision makers, it was just telling somebody to do it, but behind there was a huge clearing process.
Cool. It was
expensive. When I look now on Bitcoin, and this is one part where I say a system like Bitcoin makes sense. Within an hour, you can transfer billions around the globe from one party to the other party at a very reasonable price. I think the Bitcoin per transaction price is somewhere between $3 and $60 right now. It just fluctuates over time, depending on the on the traffic on the chain. I'm not an expert in that, but this is one use case where I think it makes sense. I mean, when companies start integrating Bitcoin into their balance sheets and it looks like it's happening, M&A becomes pretty simple. Transferring money becomes pretty simple. So,
well, I think we will see. The jury is out on what will happen. And also, there may be new cryptos that may be technologically more advanced than Bitcoin. Don't have an answer to that. But then again, it will be interesting to see when will the startup companies start raising capital in Bitcoins instead of euros or dollars.
That's a good question. I mean, Tesla had, I think Elon Musk bought $1.5 billion.
And then he sold it.
He sold it already?
Yeah, he said that he has changed his mind, actually. It's not a
good... Okay.
So,
yeah, we will see. We will see where the world is heading. I mean, it's getting more complex, but I think overall a good direction. And this is coming back to the point, who should have the power of trying out new things? Should it be politicians or entrepreneurs? I see a lot of dynamic on the corporate level to try out things, to try new things, to develop society in a good direction. I also see the same intent with politicians. But I think the core focus of politics for me should be to set the regulations right. So like Europe, that we have an open market, open borders, that we have a transparent tax system that is uncomplicated. I think this is enough work to solve. And let the entrepreneurs focus on solving other problems that are more suited to be put in that area.
I agree. But then it looks like when whoever has power, the politicians, they just cannot keep their hands off micromanagement. And then it is very difficult to leave solutions on crucial issues to market forces, because then you cannot take credit for it. It is kind of psychologically easier for them to have a specific project and then take credit for it, even if that does more harm elsewhere and is contradictory to another specific project elsewhere. So then we end up with situations where a poor entrepreneur does not know what is legal and what is not, because there are two laws that are in conflict with each other, and that's not nice. I'm sure I have lived in three countries, well, actually five, but for a longer time in three countries in Europe, Finland, United Kingdom, and Switzerland. And I am sure it is not possible to move from one country to another without breaking some laws. There's always a law that you don't know exists, and then you break it, and then no one cares. There was the former Estonian president, Thomas Ilves, who once said that he had, while being an advisor in a company, he had learned that if you drive a modern car like Tesla from Netherlands to Belgium, you break 15 privacy laws, and no one cares. I have not done my DD on that, but when it comes from an ex-president of a country, that's probably true.
Yeah, I think there is some truth in it. When I think on the complexity of doing business in Europe, working together cross borders, it's really still complicated. So I think there's a lot of room for improvement. But it's going in the other direction. It's also what I saw in COVID. It's more micromanagement, more regulations, more laws. And this is also then going towards a situation where people don't know, do they break laws? Does it matter? Doesn't it matter? And I think this insecurity on the market is just not good for fostering world-class companies.
Mm, true. That is unfortunately true. Well, that's one of the common themes in the sectors I'm active in, life sciences and fintech. These are the most heavily regulated. So somebody called me a regulation masochist when I do injustice. And of course, the regulation serves a purpose. They have good intention. And when executed well, they can actually facilitate business and not impede it. But too often, unfortunately, the good intention turns into a hindrance for new ideas and scaling up.
Yeah, this was interesting in 2008, and as Bitcoin emerged out of the chaos of a failing banking system. How do you see this trend with cryptocurrencies? What's your view on that? I mean, you mentioned gold. What will the crypto world look like in 10 years, in your opinion, as a fintech expert?
I think there will be more of them, and not necessarily Bitcoin being the dominant one. But I do think that in the end, the central banks will launch their own e-currencies, mm-hmm. Which then will compete with the cryptos. But then the real question is money creation. Because the central bank does not create money, it is the banking system. Mm-hmm. So how do you create a banking system for cryptos? You would need somebody who takes crypto deposits and then multiplies that and issues loans. So the classical banking money multiplier stuff. I haven't seen that. I just saw actually today a Finnish company had raised money from Coinbase mm-hmm. and others who do a little bit to that direction. They issue loans in fiat currency. And then the customer can how does it work? Sorry, which way around? Yeah, it was hand out loans in fiat currency so that the customer can invest in cryptos, which is first time I heard of that. I true crypto believer probably would do it the other way around. But then at least that is first mechanism where some kind of money creation start involving crypto starts to emerge. But then for the real thing to happen, you would need a crypto bank that takes deposits in Bitcoin and hands out Bitcoin loans and has all these services around that. Mm. And maybe there exists one, but I have not heard of one yet.
I'm new to the field. For me, it's still complicated and difficult to understand. It's a completely new thing. I'm trying to understand it for 4 years now, and I'm still feels like I'm failing. So I'm not an expert. I think the traditional banking system was set up to distribute money and gold around the world, basically. So it's the last.
Yeah.
Question is, do we really need this traditional banking system anymore? If wasn't that the initial intent of Satoshi Nakamoto to just prove that all the functions of a banking system, which evolves around distributing cash and distributing money? It was the explanation I got in, I think, back in the 90s when the leader of a huge Austrian bank just said the focus of any bank should be distributing money, bringing money to people, and that's it. So I think this was something that resembled Bitcoin. Just say you don't need a traditional system anymore. It can be automated. But I'm not an expert in that, so just guessing. I hope to get the solution to everything from you. You're the expert in this field.
Well, I'm possibly more expert than you, but I don't think anyone really is expert in this field. Cryptos, they are complicated. But then on the other hand, the basic economic laws do not change. They mm-hmm. are technology yeah. independent, technology agnostic. So what was true with gold in ancient Egypt, what was true in fiat currencies or gold standard will also be true with cryptos in the end.
Yeah.
And then it is about trust of people. Who do you trust to have retain wealth and what kind of stuff you expect in payments? There have been parts in history when the states had that trust, gold-backed gold standard or otherwise, it may be something else going forward. I personally would rather lend money by buying bonds of McDonald's than bonds of Greece, at the moment, but I'm a minority opinion here. I'm probably wrong because the market tells me that Greece is more trustworthy than McDonald's corporation. So you see, I mean, it's not a simple question to answer.
I'm a member of the tech sect, so I'm a true believer in growth stocks and in the success of technology and teams that move technology forward also in the coming 10 years. I'm highly impressed by people like Jeff Bezos, for example, who proved that with a sound idea and a profound execution, it's really possible to create significant wealth and improve society tremendously. I'm not a critic of Amazon in any way. When I just look at what he did for the people during the lockdowns. So just imagine a lockdown without Amazon, a lockdown without internet companies, a lockdown without Facebook. A lockdown in the 90s would have meant isolation. Today, everything got delivered and we live in the best times ever. So when I want to buy something, I go online, I get it delivered for free as a Prime member to my doorstep. And this is pretty amazing. I was not aware of that before the pandemic. And so I agree to that, what you said earlier, that there are good sides to the lockdowns and the pandemic to discover technology from a new way. I'm also impressed by Mark Zuckerberg or what Steve Jobs did with the smartphones. All these things really helped to move society forward. And this is the reason why I say, I mean, we should help when such personalities emerge. It's rare, but then we should really look to support them and to move their ideas forward to change the world to the better. And I think there are enough entrepreneurs on the market. So let's just see that Europe becomes a united market and less regulated and more access to capital, especially in the early stages. Then I'm pretty sure that also European tech can go back to become again, like it was in the 90s, players in the major league of tech, and which I don't see currently.
Agreed. Are there any issues we agreed we would cover?
I think we had a very nice conversation. Let me ask you one final question. Yeah. In this world of complexity, when someone wants to start a company in Europe, what's your most important advice to young entrepreneurs these days?
I have very conservative advice. I would advise to first work for a few years in a company. Because obviously if you graduate and start a company immediately, then financing is one issue, but then you also learn a lot of basic things that you don't then need to learn again on your own expense, basically. So generally, that is good advice. Of course, there are exceptions. There are companies that I have seen where people have started while still in university and never graduate. So there are exceptions to every rule. But in general terms, I think the advice would be to work first for a few years for somebody else. And then also, after that, obviously, it becomes more difficult to quit your day job when you get used to the paycheck and all that. But then it just tests you how committed you are, how much you believe in your own ideas, so that you want to do it. And then also, if you don't like working for somebody else, then that experience will give you strength later as a entrepreneur, because you remember that, yeah, I tried that and I left it. I don't want to go back there.
I think also for entrepreneurs, there will always be someone we need to work for. I think entrepreneurship is service to other people. It doesn't matter if it's a boss or if it's a customer. Tero, thank you very much for this nice conversation. I always enjoy speaking with you and hearing your insights into the industry. If you don't mind, I put your LinkedIn contact data into the description of the podcast and invite people to reach out to you if they have further questions.
Definitely, yes. One thing we didn't touch was chess boxing, which I also advise everybody who's listening to this to check www.nordicchessboxing.com. I'm organizing the, aside from the stuff we discussed here, I'm also organizing a chess boxing event in Helsinki on 2nd of October. So I think that's a great support for anyone who is investing and being active in life sciences field to really take your mind out of the ordinary business and to focus on the two very demanding disciplines.
Yeah, we'll add it to the description as well. I think it's an interesting concept to combine chess competitions with boxing competitions in one single event. How much time does it take? Is it a whole day event or is it...
That's one evening. There will be four fights and fight night from 7 to 11. And so chess and boxing are in the same event. So you can win by either knockout or by checkmate. So that's that tests you both physically and mentally. Like they say in Latin, mens sana in corpore sano. Mm-hmm.
And there will also be, is this the dinner food at the location?
Sure. Yeah. Or you can watch it by, you can buy the stream ticket and watch it. So.
Oh, it's a streaming.
Yeah, but there will be stream. I can send you a link. So.
Yeah, send me the link in the bulletin description. When is it exactly?
2nd of October. But if you ever have needed an excuse to visit Helsinki, that would be, could be.
Would be a great thing. I hope we can travel in October and we don't get another lockdown. It would be great to attend physically at the event. Tero, thank you very much for the nice conversation. Let's stay in touch and revisit the content in a year from now and chat again.
Good. Thank you, Cristiano. Have a good day and a great summer.
Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please share the podcast and make sure you've subscribed. Have a great day.